Good afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live from 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock in the afternoon, daily, Monday through Friday, from 2 to 3, that's Pacific time. We have people listening in other time zones, but I think our audience is a pretty smart batch. They can figure out what the time zone difference is from where they are. If you are a person with questions in your mind about the Bible or about Christianity or about your own religious ideas, feel free to give me a call. We're here to talk about those questions. The number is 1-800-438-5090. You can even call. In fact, I should say you can especially call if you have a difference of viewpoint from the host and would like to banter a little bit about that, might want to present another side, defend another side. You're always welcome to do that here. If you call to do that, you'll find I'll give you a lot of leeway. Because I like to have the presentation of more than one view here. The reason for that is because the purpose of the program is to examine what the Bible teaches. It's not for the purpose of showcasing this host's private viewpoints about subjects. The purpose of the program is to examine the scriptures, and if there are other reasonably credible viewpoints than my own, and I know there are on many issues, then I'd like for my listeners to be able to hear about it. So the number is 1-800-438-5090. And our first caller today is Sandy calling from San Jose, California. Hi, Sandy. Good to hear from you.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. I like the fact you said your audience is intelligent, so I consider to be the first intelligent person calling in today. So
that's right. That's
there
right.
You go. Hey, Steve, I had a question on, let's see here. It's in Romans 12:19. Do not take revenge, my friends, but leave room for God's wrath, for it's written, it's mine to avenge, I will repay evil. And then the next line is the one that seems to be a little bit confusing. On the contrary, if anybody is hungry, feed him, and thirsty, give him drink. In doing so, you will heap burning coals on his head. And, of course, that's picked up from the Old Testament, I think the Psalms.
It's from Proverbs 25, yeah.
There you go, Proverbs. You're more intelligent than I am. But it almost looks like, I mean...
You notice I didn't refute you about that, but I'm probably not. I'm probably not. I was going to let that go by. Go ahead.
I wish you were wrong right now, but you're not. So the question is, the implication is that if you, obviously you would let God do his wrath on people. There's another verse that says, the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. It's another verse.
Right.
So this is kind of implying that if we stay back and let God handle his own wrath, he'll put coals on his head, but that's not exactly loving our neighbor as ourselves. So am I reading this thing right? Am I off on this?
Well, it is. It is loving our neighbor as we love ourselves. We would commit our case into the hands of God rather than have people judge us, wouldn't we? And that's what we're doing. When your enemy hungers and you give him food, or your enemy is thirsty, you give him drink, basically you're not treating him like an enemy. You're treating him like a friend. Now, what Paul is saying, and what the Proverbs that he's quoting is saying, which is, like I said, Proverbs 25, is that when you do that, you're heaping coals of fire in his head. What's that mean? Well, in connection with Paul's quote from Deuteronomy 32, God says, vengeance is mine, I will repay. What Paul is saying throughout here is that if you do not avenge yourself, then there is an unsettled matter, and God will settle it. Now, I want God to settle matters with me rather than have people do it. If somebody is angry at me about something and is inclined to take vengeance on me, I'd rather they didn't. I'd much rather it was left in God's hands, because even if I deserve punishment, and even if God's going to punish me, I know at least God won't punish me disproportionately. I know that God is just. I know that God is merciful. I'd much rather commit myself into God's hands than man's. Remember what David said about
right.
that?
Yeah, when he was... Yeah.
When he said, let me fall into God's hands and not man's, I'd much rather come under God's judgment than man's judgment. Now, that's a strange thing to say, because many Christians talk about God's judgment as if it's a horrendous thing, and I'm sure for some people it will be. But the very fact that David said, I'd rather fall into God's judgment than man's, suggests that God is a more just and a more merciful judge than man is. Now, if this man that Paul is talking about is your enemy and he's hungry, if you have a carnal and vindictive attitude toward him. You might just say, well, it serves him right. Let him go hungry. But instead, if you treat him like a friend, that is, you do not treat him like an enemy. You leave it to God to decide how to treat him. Then, indeed, your kindness to him leaves the matter unsettled and therefore heaps up on his head the coals of fire. Now I will tell you this. There's some preaching out there that is squeamish about this and has tried to find some way to say that heaping coals of fire on your friend's head or your enemy's head is a kindness to do. They're trying to bring this into harmony with what they think, you know, the New Testament ethic should be. And they say, well, you'll find this in some commentaries. It's absurd as far as I'm concerned. But they say, well, in those days, you know,
the fire needed. Yeah, go ahead.
Right. That, exactly. They had a community fire there,
right.
And everyone needed coals to break their bread in the morning and so forth. And you know, if their oven fire had gone out, they go to the community bonfire or whatever
to get
coals. And of course, in the Middle East, they carry things on their head. So if you were heaping coals on a person's head, that's kind of like helping them up with it. You know, helping them get the coals from the community fire onto their the proper place on their head so they can carry it home. To me, that's the most absurd suggestion that anyone could make. First of all, it's such an arcane kind of favor. If it's talking about doing them a favor, certainly there are favors that would be more obviously favors. I mean, helping someone up with a jar of coals on their head, it's not obvious that people need that. Most people can lift that up themselves. I mean, it'd be more like saying, if you give them water when they're thirsty, that's sort of like, well, that's like giving them water when they're thirsty, you know, because giving them water when they're thirsty is a nice thing to do.
Right.
But the proverb isn't saying that you're doing a nice thing to them. It's saying that you're leaving the judgment in God's hands.
God's hands. Oh,
and
okay.
therefore, whatever judgment they deserve, you are not you're not deflating that at all. You're leaving it fully in God's hands. And as long as you're doing kindness to them in exchange for their evil toward you, then you're doing the right thing, and their judgment is accumulating.
Got it. Yeah. I'd heard that other interpretation, and it didn't quite resonate with me. So
It shouldn't. It's ridiculous.
It did. And so, hey, one other one here, and I'm going to hopefully make this brief because I think you've talked a lot about Sheol and death and Hades and all these things. This is my very specific question on this. When David says, you know, I'm going down to the grave or to Sheol, is he talking about his body or his soul? That confused me. So, like, we're all going to die. We're all going to go into a grave somewhere, unless we're, you know, what have you, unless we're, burned.
Mm-hmm.
But what did he mean by that? Was his soul?
Well, first of all, I'm not really sure the Old Testament saints or Old Testament parties had a clear conception of the distinction between a body and a soul. The word soul in the Old Testament is nephesh, and it's the word for just a person. You know, there were eight souls saved on the ark. That means there are eight people. And even the animals are called nephesh, souls, in the book of Genesis. And so the word soul in the Old Testament is not distinctly separated from the idea of the body as it appears to be in the New Testament. Now, there are a few people, not many, it's not distinguished in the New Testament either. And they don't believe in a soul that's separate from the body. They believe that the functions we call soul, or the functions of mind, are merely the products of brain activity. In other words, their body activity is not, there's no soul. There's not much biblical reason to support that, as near as I can tell. But there certainly are, there is reason to question whether the Old Testament saints had a clear conception of separation of body and soul into two different things. Now, it does talk in Isaiah chapter 13 about the king of Babylon going down into Sheol, and there the kings that he has supplanted in his lifetime will rise up to, as it were, kind of mock him and say, oh, you who disturbed the nations, now you've become like one of us. It's like there's a kind of a concept of the shades in hell, or the shadies in hell, which are kind of like the concept of a soul, but they're probably more poetic than real. I mean, that is to say, it's not really saying that there will be a real encounter necessarily between the king of Babylon and these kings. Although, I mean, it could be so. I'm not saying it couldn't be so, but it's a poetic passage, and it sounds to me as if it's kind of just making a point poetically. There's no real clear indication in the Old Testament that the Old Testament saints understood what I think New Testament does make clear, and that is that we do have a part of us that lives on after we are absent from the body, as Paul put it.
Right.
So when David talked about going to Sheol, I don't think he was thinking, well, my body will go to Sheol, but my soul will go to heaven. And I don't think he was saying, my body will go to the grave, but my soul will go to Sheol. I think to him, Sheol, just in the Old Testament, Sheol just meant where the dead are, whatever that means, conscious or unconscious. Just all people, when they leave this life, they go to Sheol. I'm sure for many people that just meant their body rots in the grave.
Right.
Others may have had the concept that, you know, well, when my body's in the grave, maybe I have a part of me that still, you know, lives on somewhere. But it was never clearly distinguished in the Old Testament. Not until the New Testament do you get that.
Steve, you got to get that book out, man. Three Views of Hell. But I know you've got a thousand things you're doing.
I have a thousand things I'm doing, but that's going to be near the top of my list real soon. I'm going to have to take some time away from travel and just put myself away somewhere, hide myself somewhere so I can write that.
Sounds good. Steve, thanks for the help as always. I appreciate it.
Okay, Sandy, thanks for your call.
Take care. Bye-bye.
God bless you. Bye now. Let's talk next to Renee from Albany, Oregon. Renee, welcome to The Narrow Path, and thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So my question today is, and I'm not exactly sure where it is because I don't have a Bible with me, but I think it's Hebrews toward the end of chapter 7. It might be toward the early part of chapter 8 as well. It talks about Jesus being made perfect through obedience. And I was wondering if you could elaborate on that a little bit, because my first inclination is like, well, Jesus has and always was, and Jesus created the earth. So Jesus is perfect, and so that kind of surprised me when that caught my attention.
Yeah, well, there's two statements in the book of Hebrews that are similar and that give Christians the same problem. One is that he learned obedience through the things that he suffered. And the other is that he became, it says, the author of their salvation was made perfect through sufferings, which is in Hebrews chapter 2, actually, verse 11. Verse 10, I guess it is. He was made perfect through sufferings. Now, in that statement it says the author of their salvation was made perfect. The word perfect, the Greek word perfect, can mean what we mean by perfect. That means, you know, absolutely superior, supreme, flawless. But it also has the meaning in different contexts of complete or mature. There are a number of places in the New Testament where this word means complete and other places where it means mature, depending on the context. Here, I think that means complete. The King James and the New King James both translated as perfect, which is a possible translation of that word, but I think it may not be the right choice of English terms for it here. Because what he's saying is that Jesus became the author of our salvation. In that role, he was made complete through suffering. Says he was not able to bring our salvation as he is now without first suffering. Before he suffered, he was not able to accomplish this salvation. He became the author of our salvation completely. He was made complete in that role. He was before he suffered, though he was willing to save, he had not done everything that needs to be done in order to save. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I think it means. I think if you take the word perfect as complete, it may help.
So if I look at those words as far as they're written in the Greek, maybe, and look at a Greek dictionary, it'll show that distinction, or?
I think, yeah, it will. It will. Do you have a Vines, dictionary?
No,
well,
I don't.
Do you have a Strong's Concordance?
Strong's. Uh-huh.
Yeah, you should be able to find it there easy enough.
Oh, that's helpful. Thank you.
Okay, Renee. Now, of course, Strong's isn't going to explain the meaning of the verse. It'll just tell the meanings of the possible meanings of that word. My explanation of the meaning of the verse is my own take on it. But yeah, Strong's should confirm the meaning of the word.
Okay.
Okay, Renee.
Okay, thanks a lot.
God bless you.
You too.
Bye now. And that opens a line for you if you'd like to be on the program. The line can be accessed by dialing or. There's no more dialing anymore. We're still talking about dialing on the radio because it shows how far behind we are. You don't dial a number anymore. You punch the number. What do you do? What is punching it? I don't know what you'd say. You just, what do? You key in the number. Oh, I don't even know. But even if I don't know the right word for it, I think most of you know the technology and most of you know the mechanics of it. You push those buttons on the top of your phone and you push these numbers, 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. And you can get right through to me. I'm going to talk to Flora next from Arlington, Washington. Hi, Flora. Welcome to the Narrow. Or is it Fiora? Let me see.
It's Laura.
Oh, it's Laura. My call screen has an F at the beginning there. Sorry about that.
No, that's all right. I'm dialing for doctrine.
I'm dialing for doctrine. We should call the program that.
Yeah.
All right.
You know, I've just barely touched on reading some of the early church fathers, and I just, you know, it kind of looks like Clement is talking about almost like apostolic succession. You know,
you're talking about Clement of Rome, not Clement of Alexandria, right?
You know, I don't have the books right in front of me, yeah. And I didn't hear what you said. So.
Oh, okay. There's two Clements, but I think you're talking about Clement of Rome.
Yeah, the early Clement. He died
He's the earlier one.
99. Yeah.
Yeah. Some people think he is the Clement that Paul mentions in the book of Romans. Yeah.
Yeah, I did read something that said that they thought that they were talking about that he was the fellow worker in Philippians. But
mm-hmm.
Do you think that that's true, that it's the same Clement?
Well, I don't know if all scholars would agree about that, and it's entirely possible. I don't think that you can tell by reading the book of Clement whether he's the same one or not. So
okay.
all we know is he had the same name as a friend of Paul's who was in Rome. And
he lived within the first 100 years after
right.
Christ.
Although
you know,
Clement was not an unusual name in Roman times, but go ahead.
Well, I was just curious because some of the reading that I did almost sounded like he was talking about apostolic succession, that those that were ordained, you know, to to be teachers and carry on the leadership in the church were not chosen by the community in the church, but it was just a laying on of hands and a continual apostolic type of succession, which that just kind of blew me away to think, oh, my gosh, is that what he's really saying?
Well, the Roman Catholics will read apostolic succession into that passage. It does sound like it if you're thinking of their way. He does say that the apostles laid hands on persons to, you know, take over after they were gone. It doesn't mean that they were to take over as apostles, though. I mean, even in their earlier life, Paul and Barnabas laid hands on men in every church to appoint them to eldership. And that doesn't, there's a distinction between an apostle and an elder. When Paul made a listing of various gifts that God gave, he mentioned apostles and prophets and evangelists and pastors and teachers. Now, the word pastor, the Greek word is poimen, it means shepherds.
Mm-hmm.
And the shepherds of the church, as we can see from, for example, what Paul says in Acts 20 or Peter says in 1 Peter 5, the pastors of the church were the elders. And so elders were different than apostles. They're listed in a different position. Apostles, Christ appointed the apostles, and they were unique. You know, they remain the 12 apostles to this day. You see, the Roman Catholics say, well, you know, Christ is the king, and the 12 apostles were his cabinet. But just like in David's kingdom, you know, when the next king came to power, new guys filled that cabinet. So when the apostles died, we had to have new apostles. No, there is no new king since Jesus. Jesus is the same king, and the apostles are still his cabinet. And we see that, for example, in the book of Revelation, where the foundation stones of the city, the New Jerusalem, are
the 12
apostles. Yeah,
right.
I mean, and Jesus said, you 12 will sit on 12 thrones judging the tribes of Israel. The 12 apostles are unique. There's not a new 12 apostles every generation. So
okay.
to say that the apostles laid hands on successors in what role? Well, the Roman Catholics can read into it, and they do read into it, that they were successors to apostleship. But we read in the Bible, not of the apostles appointing new apostles. We read of the apostles laying hands on people to appoint elders in every city. And certainly the elders succeeded the role of leadership in the absence of the apostles, even after Paul would move on to the next town. You know, when Paul came to a town, let's say Corinth, or well, let's not say Corinth, because we don't know that he ever appointed elders there. That's one exception. But let's say Ephesus. Paul came to Ephesus, and he stayed there for 3 years. He was the leader. He was the founder. He established the church. He was the apostolic leader there. When he left elders in charge. Were they his successors? Yes. They were his successors to the leadership of the Ephesian church. But they weren't apostles. To say that he left people to fill the position in the church that he had filled there, which was that of leading the church, is not to say that they became apostles like him. And okay. if they did, it was well within his lifetime. So the apostles weren't, you know, the apostles then were just, you know, multiplying apostles everywhere they went. I don't think that's true. I think Jesus is the one who sends the apostles. That's what the word apostle means, is a sent one. And when you're an apostle of Jesus Christ, it's because Jesus sent you. The apostles didn't send other apostles, I don't believe. I think that they appointed elders. And I believe that's what Clement is referring to.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Okay, Laura. Thanks for your call.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right. We're going to talk next to Jay from Albany, Oregon. We have a line open that you can take if you like right now. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. You can get on the phone and call me if you have questions or difference of opinion. We can talk about it right here. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Jay, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Hi.
Hi.
My question is one, excuse me, there's a passage during, you know, a very dramatic time in the Gospels when Jesus is carrying his cross to Golgotha,
That's right.
And because, you know, he was beaten so severely, it states that the Romans had to enlist one of the bystanders to help him carry it, or I'm not sure if it was carry it for him, or help him.
To carry it for him. Simon, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, you know, as I read the Bible, I'm just always amazed at the levels of meaning that God incorporates. You know, and I couldn't help but think that that was just sort of a random event at a time like that. And I just wondered, I was talking with a Christian about this once. He said that he thought the person that was enlisted, I don't have my Bible with me. Was it Simon?
Simon the Cyrene.
Yeah, Simon the Cyrene. He said he thought that later Paul writes that his family, some family connections, were of service to the church.
That's true.
But I guess where I'm wondered about, and I don't know that there's really an absolute answer we can, you know, identify, but I just wondered if maybe God was indicating, you know, understanding the sufficiency of Christ's sacrifice, but he was going to involve humankind in salvation of mankind, or am I just kind of reading too much into that? Or is that anything you've ever heard discussed or written about?
Well, I've not heard that point specifically made. What you're saying is that the death of Jesus was, of course, the pivot point of salvation for mankind, and even in that event, there was another individual besides Jesus that was a partner or a participant or a helper carrying the cross. And that man's family later also were known in the Church of Rome. So you're asking if the significance of that is that even in the salvation of the world, God doesn't just use Jesus alone, but us as well? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, I guess that's a good way to kind of summarize
I've never heard that connection made, but it is obvious that God does, in fact, use us in reaching the world. I mean, Jesus died, but we have to carry, as it were, the cross to the world. We are partners with Christ. We are, as Paul put it about himself and Apollos, said, we are laborers together with God. And he was talking about how in reaching Corinth, Paul had come there and brought the gospel, and Apollos had come there and watered those seeds, and God gave the increase. So he said that, you know, God's in it and we're in it. We're laborers together. We're co-laborers with God. So I guess to make a good preaching point, I don't know if God, you know, included Simon the Cyrenian in order that we would reach that particular conclusion or get that lesson out of it, but I don't know how we could ever be sure that that was intentional or not. But if I were preaching about the need for how God includes us in reaching the world and saving the world, that might be a suitable point to bring up as an illustration. We'd have to leave it unanswered whether, like you said, it may not be answerable, whether God did it that way in order that we could make that point in preaching it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, it just seems like something at that such a, like you said, a pivotal time and a dramatic time that you know, just a casual event would be, you know, happen at that point. But so okay, well, I don't know if you have other callers waiting. I do have another question I could ask.
Okay, my lines are full, but I don't mind taking another question. Go ahead.
Okay, I think it's fairly brief. This is another one I've kind of wondered the meaning about, or you can make it brief, the answer. Do you know how there's a passage that talks about don't lay up for yourself riches on earth?
Treasures on earth, uh-huh.
Right, but rather riches in heaven. And, you know, riches is pretty vague, but sometimes, you know, I'm an older person, I'm nearing retirement, and I'm kind of like most people. I have the IRA thing, and my where I work, they have a retirement plan, and I kind of look at that, and you know, it's up in the six figures, and I think, you know, I don't know, is that am I kind of intruding into that?
Well, I understand the question. I mean, it does. When Jesus said, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth," certainly that is what people do when they set money aside for retirement. They certainly are laying up treasures on earth. Is it a violation of what he has in mind? Now, there's another passage that Jesus used. I think it's in the 12th chapter of Luke, but I could be wrong about the location. About a rich man who was a farmer, and his fields produced abundant grain, and he said, what am I going to do? I don't have room to store all this grain. I know, I'll tear down my granaries. I'll build bigger granaries. I'll fill them up, and I'll have so much grain, I can say to myself, soul, you've got much goods laid up for many years. Just take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. And this certainly sounds like a man going into retirement. You know, he's laid up more than he needs for the moment, and he's saying, now what? Actually, as Jesus tells this parable, he says, the man says, what shall I do? And he says, I know, I'll build bigger granaries and store them up that can relax. Now, that's the wrong answer to the question, what shall I do? If you've got surplus, I think Jesus is saying there's some use for that right now. There's people who have needs right now, and it's the wrong answer to say, well, I have a surplus, what shall I do? I'll just make myself comfortable for the rest of my life. And that's not what God gives you your surplus for. Now, on the other hand, there is something called stewardship. And stewardship doesn't only mean giving. It means managing. Sometimes when you hear sermons on stewardship, really what it is, it's stewards about giving money to the church, which is part of stewardship. But stewardship is just the whole enterprise of managing what God has given you. Now, if you can see that you're going to be out of work at a certain point in time, and that God has provided for you some way that you can make provision for yourself after that point, then it might be that that's how God will lead you to do so. But what I think the whole point of Jesus' statement, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, is this. It's emphatic. He says, do not lay up treasures for yourselves on earth. You see, in the early church, we're told twice that the early Christians did not consider that the things they had were their own. And the reason for that is when you become a Christian, everything you have, including yourself, becomes God's. You belong to Jesus. And therefore, everything is his. Everything's at his disposal. And that means that you are stewarding his stuff. You're doing that now, even before you retire. It's not just after you retire. All your life, from the moment you become a servant of Christ, you become the steward of his things. And honest, there will come a time when he has his stewards give account to him for what they did with his stuff. Now, there's no reason to be ashamed of, laying up something so that your kids won't have to support you or something necessarily when you're older. If that's what God wants you to do. See, I don't feel like anyone can tell someone else what God wants them to do with their money, with God's money. I think each of us has to do what we believe God wants us to do with our money. I would say this. I don't intend to lay up anything for my retirement, partly because I don't ever plan to retire. But if I was in an ordinary job that wasn't ministry, I would, of course, look forward to retiring so that I could go into ministry. Since I'm in ministry, there's no need to ever even contemplate retirement. I can't imagine why a minister would ever want to retire. But even if I were going to retire, I don't know that I would want to lay up stuff for the future, because I'm a great believer in living by faith and seeking first the kingdom of God and his righteousness and letting God provide all the other things for you. But that doesn't mean that he doesn't lead somebody to put some money aside for the future. I mean, there is the example of the ant given in Proverbs. You know, he sees the winter is coming, so he gathers extra in the summer. There's the example of Joseph. Joseph knew 7 years of famine were coming. So during the 7 years of abundance, they laid up something. God, in other words, provided enough in the earlier season to help the whole community in the later season. Now, the main thing to note there is that the ant, when it's collecting food, it's not collecting for itself. It's collecting for the ant colony. It's collecting for itself and everybody else. Joseph, when he laid up treasures in Egypt, he wasn't doing it for himself. He was doing it for the whole country. In other words, there are times when your love for your neighbor would incline you to foresee, sparse times coming and put something aside so that at that time as well as now you can help people. Because what you're laying aside is not yours anyway. Now, if I felt that God was leading me to lay aside a big chunk of money for the future, my view would be that chunk of money is not mine any more than the money I have in my hands right now is mine. I don't own anything. God owns it all. And therefore, the money I have in my pocket and the money I may have in the bank, if I have any — I don't usually have any money in the bank, but I sometimes do. And certainly if I had something laid up for retirement, which I do not and never will, probably, that's all God's money. And what Jesus says, don't lay up for yourselves treasures on earth. I think what Jesus is teaching his disciples is that they shouldn't be thinking exclusively of themselves in terms of what their money is for. It may be that, you've amassed enough money that you can stop working at your job and live on what you've put aside. And in doing so, you are not a burden on others. Because if you didn't do that, you'd have to depend on others, perhaps, to provide for you. And so there may be a sense in which you're being generous. There may be a sense in which you're being kind to those who otherwise would have the burden of your support fall upon them. On the other hand, if you're just laying up money so you can be comfortable and you're not thinking in terms of that money being God's, and you're not thinking of that money being available for the poor if they need it, then I think that's wrongheaded. But see, I think that anyone who's got the attitude that Jesus is recommending, they think about their present possessions as belonging to God, and therefore they'd be willing, if necessary, to give it all away. I mean, if Jesus said, give it to the poor and come follow me, we should be ready to do that in an instant. And we should be ready to do that even with if we're in retirement. And if there's some money laid aside for our years to come, if God says, listen, give all that away, just trust me and follow me, we should be willing to do it.
Yeah, like he said to that one rich man who couldn't
right.
let go of it. Yeah.
All right. So it's not so much about forbidding you to have, something stored away. The question is, are you looking out for yourself only, or are you recognizing that what you have is God's? You're not laying up for yourself treasures on earth. You may be laying up treasures like the ant does or like Joseph did, But that's for the needs of anyone who needs it. I mean, that's what God wants us to do. That's God's command to us about our goods even now. Paul said that those who have much should help the poor. He says, so that those who gathered much have no extra, and those who gathered little have no lack. Paul said that in 2 Corinthians. He was quoting from Exodus. So, I mean, we don't have very much that attitude as American churchgoers today, but it's still in the Bible.
No. Okay, well, some excellent points. thank you so much.
Okay, Jay. God bless you. Thanks for calling.
Okay. You bet.
Bye now. It's a hard saying. Who can hear it? Ron, with a question from Henderson, Nevada. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Good afternoon. Good answers, et cetera. Hey, I'm just going to go down the path of evolution and creation right now.
Okay.
I'm walking the dog the other day, and I'm thinking about some sex. And I don't know, I started thinking about fossil fuels and the way the world and, let's just say, the evolutionary view has stated to us that fossil fuels comes from the, I guess you could say, the decay and the pressure over the years of dinosaurs dying. And I guess that's where they get the word fossil fuels from.
That's what they're thinking, yeah.
Okay, so naturally, if it comes from something else, they're off hands because most of the world is trying to tell us that we need the fossil fuels and all that kind of noise. But my point is the internal combustion engine has been around for plus or minus about 100 years, and the refining of oil, I guess, turns into gasoline, and don't know much about that kind of stuff, but that's we've been pulling this stuff out of, let's just say, the Earth and Saudi, you know, the Middle East, under the oceans and stuff like that. And I'm thinking to myself, we have been pulling this oil out, if you will, refining it to whatever degree, and we've pulled it out for 100 years, and I guess the mind that I suppose doesn't think about it, that just keeps pushing the word fossil fuel, doesn't realize that how many possible dinosaurs could have ever lived on this particular Earth and then been layered over and, you know, turned into this particular fuel, to the point where after 100 years of drawing it out of the Earth through whatever means we do technologically, you would think that there couldn't be that many dinosaurs to create that much oil after 100-some years. And I'm thinking to myself, nobody, let's just say from the Christian standpoint, not to say that, you know, I'm some new thinker or something like that about it, but it's like nobody really attacks it and says, you know what, did you ever think that if we took that much oil out of the ground, we probably would be done with it based on the number of dinosaurs that possibly roam the Earth? And maybe the possibility is that they're really not fossil fuels, that they were always there when the Earth was created, and only because of our technology or the advancement of thinking, if you will. Maybe the guy just left it there because we possibly need it or something like that. I'm not suggesting that you would have an answer, but I've never heard any pastors in the Christian world, or for that matter, any type of world, say, you know, we took too much out of the ground already. That is virtually impossible to have had that many huge beasts roaming the earth to turn it into that. I mean, we're talking millions, if not trillions, of gallons of this black gold, if you will, that has come out of the earth. It seems unrealistic. I mean, they do find the bones, so that means the bones didn't turn into oil. I don't know. I was just musing the other day, and I'm like,
let me just say this. I don't know much about the science of it either. I know that the conventional wisdom is that the coal is fossilized plant life, and that the oil is fossilized animal life, and yes, that the dinosaurs and their decayed bodies and so forth were the primary contributors to the oil reserves that we have in the Earth. Now, I've never known how they know this.
Right.
But they may. I mean, they may have some way of knowing. I mean, to me, the idea that coal is compressed vegetation makes very good sense. I mean, that to me, that's almost a no-brainer. But that oil is compressed dinosaur, you know, fat and muscle and so forth. I'm not sure how they know that. There may be some way they know that. And I'm not saying they're wrong. I just don't know how they know that. But what you're suggesting, at least my present level of ignorance, what you're suggesting seems reasonable. That is, that I think some people are very unreasonable in saying that the dinosaurs never lived and that God just put dinosaur bones in the earth to fool people. To me, that's an absurdity. But to suggest that God put oil in the planet, I don't know that that's absurd. I mean, that's not in itself something that he'd be doing to deceive people. It may be that, that because of its usefulness, he put it there. So I honestly don't know the answer to that. Yeah, but I think you're speaking somewhat intuitively, and I guess I would be too. I'd have to say that your intuition would be similar to mine. None of us really know how many dinosaurs walked on the earth.
Right.
But still, to have all the trillions and trillions of barrels of oil that are all over the earth, if those were caused by the compression of dinosaur bodies, then you not only had to have an awful lot of dinosaurs, you had to have them all dying in the same place so they could all get compressed together. You know, you'd have to have like huge dinosaur graveyards, I would think. Now, but I admit my ignorance. I don't know much about the science of that. Maybe a geologist can call and let us know something about that.
Well, the understanding is that, you know, you've heard it said that if you tell a lie long enough, people just believe it as the truth. And I'm just suggesting that I'm not even talking about current administrations, just the scientific body politic in itself. They just suggest that, hey, this is all fossil fuels. It's taught to you all the way from kindergarten on, if you will, especially in
sure.
The public.
Sure, I'm aware of it. I'm aware that people can just buy into a prevailing theory like global warming or something like that, or
right.
evolution itself. But
right.
But on the other hand, I'm saying that I know there's been a lot of research about global warming, so that some scientists, some very significant scientists, stand against the theory of global warming being man-made, and others stand on the side of it. So it's disputable. Certainly, evolution is disputable. You've got competent scientists on both sides of that question, although the media would give you the impression that's not so, but it certainly is the case. On the matter of whether oil is fossil fuel or not, I've only heard one view. I don't know if there are scientists on the other side or not, and I'm not really sure what they use to determine that. But I'm going to have to just leave that question unanswered.
Yes, most definitely. And I thank you for your time. I appreciate always your program, and enjoy your program as usual. I hope you get another listen.
All right, Ron, and thanks for thinking outside the box.
No problem. God bless you. Have a good one, Steve. Bye.
God bless you, too. Bye.
Bye
now. All right, let's talk to Lee from Salinas, California next. Lee, good to hear from you again.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. My question was in Revelation chapter 7 on verse 3 to 6. I don't understand this. They said the seven heads and 10 horns. I understand the seven heads is represent for each nation, or the 10 horns that represent for each nation.
You're talking about Revelation 13?
No, 17.
Oh, 17. Okay, yeah. Well, it's describing the beast. The same beast was described also in chapter 13 in the same way. It has seven heads and 10 horns. Now, it is confusing because the heads seem to be identified with two different things. When the explanation is given, it says the heads are like seven hills or seven mountains where the woman sits, and they are seven kings. And then the horns are described as 10 kings, 10 different kings than the seven. And the interpretation of that beast has been given a lot of different ways. There really are far more interpretations of this beast and the woman that rides on it than I would have time even to name, much less talk much about. But yeah, the heads, the main thing to see is that the beast is symbolic for something, a government, a system of some kind, and there are seven kings associated with it. And at a somewhat further off level, maybe tributary to those, there's 10 kingdoms or 10 kings involved. Now, whether this is talking about something in the future, as many people think, or something in the past, has been, that's been disputed. A lot of people think it refers to the Roman Empire. The seven heads are said to be seven mountains, and many people have pointed out that the city of Rome used to be referred to as the city on seven hills, that was secularly, it was referred to that way. So some think that the reference to the seven mountains is a reference to the seven hills upon which Rome sits. But there's a lot of confusing interpretations of that, and instead of trying to tell you what I think it means, because that would take a very long time, and it wouldn't even matter, because it doesn't matter what I think it means. I would suggest that if you have a chance to get my book, and I'm not a book salesman. You can listen to this program for a long time without ever hearing me even mention that I have a book. But I wrote a book back in 1997 called Revelation Four Views, a parallel commentary. You can get it from any ordinary bookseller. And it gives the various views on every passage in Revelation, and including this one. And I'm going to have to just suggest that maybe you check it out in the book rather than me try to survey all the different opinions, because there's so many details that would have to be considered, and we don't have enough time really to do that here, I'm afraid.
Do your book sell on the border store?
Yeah, Borders usually has a copy on the shelves, at least they used to. The book's kind of old now. It's been out for about 13 years. But
okay,
at least...
You call that? You have your name on it?
Yeah, my name is on it. The book's called Revelation Four Views, a Parallel Commentary. My name is Steve Gregg. And you can also look it up on Amazon, and they'll deliver it to your door.
I don't have a computer.
I see. Well, yeah.
I'm on a disability. That's why I cannot pay too much.
Borders usually has it. Most of the Borders stores I've been in have a copy on the shelf, and if they don't, they'll order it for you.
Okay. Thanks very much, Steve. Thanks for taking my call, and God bless you.
God bless you, Lee. Thanks for calling. Bye now. Let's talk to an anonymous caller from an unknown place. Hello, anonymous. Welcome.
Hi, Steve.
Yes.
I am for sure wanting to believe the scriptures in the beginning, that this is a young earth. You know, that we're not living on a planet,
yeah.
You know, like they
billions
say. Billions
of years old. Mm-hmm.
But it always bothers me that they go back to what we were talking about just a few minutes ago, the oil, and
mm-hmm.
that it has to be, according to whoever says it's a billion years old, that it has to be because the oil came from dinosaurs and that it has to be really, really old to produce that. To create the oil, but
mm-hmm.
I would love to have your opinion on this, and maybe someone else has already thought about it. I'm not trying to act like I've got a new revelation or anything, but I would love to know your opinion on this. Being that the Earth is young, when the flood came, the pressure from all that water could easily have created that oil, I think, unless time is a factor in the oil. It seems to me that, you know, to create a diamond, it's pressure. They say it's
mm-hmm.
pressure, but maybe it's just pressure. But imagine all the organic matter and all the people and animals that were on the planet at the same time as the dinosaur, and then that dead matter, and then all the pressure from that water.
Yeah.
Could, in my opinion, but I'd love to hear your opinion, and I'll take your answer off the air. And thank you for all you do. I really appreciate your show.
All right. Well, thanks for your call.
Okay, bye.
Bye. Well, you make a good point, I think. It seems to me, again, I'm not a geologist. I don't know much about the science. But when they say it takes billions of years for coal to form or for oil to form, I'm not sure how anyone could say for sure that that is true. How do we know it doesn't only take thousands of years? Has anyone, you know, sat around and to see if it takes thousands or billions of years? Actually, there are some cases I've heard about, but it's kind of a weak thing for me to just say I've heard of cases. You might be able to find them on the internet, but I have heard of documented cases. I just can't put my finger on them. Of coal being formed rather rapidly in artificial conditions, or oil, too, that these things can be synthesized from their original, you know, sources, but they can be done much faster than billions of years in a controlled situation. Now, whether that's also true in a natural situation, I'm not really sure. But evolutionists shouldn't have any trouble with us extrapolating from what is done in a controlled situation to what's done in a in nature, because Richard Dawkins, for example, in his new book, The Greatest Show on Earth, which is, you know, trying to show why evolution is true, spends a lot of time pointing out that artificial selection, human-directed breeding and so forth, brings a lot of change within a species, so nature could do the same thing. Well, of course, we can't be sure that nature would do the same thing that an experimenter does in a laboratory. But if it can be done in a laboratory, then perhaps it argues that it could be done in nature too. And they have synthesized oil and coal in a much shorter period of time than thousands even of years, much less than billions, in laboratories. So I got a feeling that the idea that it took billions of years to make coal and oil is somebody's guess. And I don't think we'd be obligated to agree with their guess. I'd have to see some evidence that it can never be done more quickly before that. But you're right. I think the flood would be a good situation. That is a good theory as to the kind of situation that might cause things like that to happen. As we were talking about, if dinosaurs had to be pressed together under great pressure to make oil, I'm not sure how anything less than something like a flood would exert that pressure. I mean, ordinarily dinosaurs, we presume, would just lay down and die and then be eaten by, you know, other dinosaurs. And what would press them together into oil? There would have to be something, we would think, sudden and catastrophic that would cover them up and force their bodies to be pressed into, petroleum. But I'm not speaking as an expert about that. But I do think that sometimes we are expected to believe things without much evidence of it. And I don't mind holding out for some evidence before I believe them. Let's talk to Robert from Castroville, California next. Hi, Robert.
Hey, Steve. How you doing? I came in a little late today, and I just got the tail end of one conversation as far as evolution. So I'd like to submit for your consideration and comments about something against evolution. When the Bible says that God created all the creatures and they were to reproduce after their own kind, to me that's a slam dunk that there's no such thing as evolution. What's your comment on that? And I'll take it off the air for you. But it's good to hear from you, and I truly enjoy listening to you. And maybe someday we'll get to meet each other. How's that?
Yeah, we don't live very far away from each other.
No, we don't. We really don't. And I'm trying to get to the point where I can get up and see you at your next meeting. I keep checking your website. So
Let me tell you this while you're mentioning it.
Okay.
It's not posted at the website. That's
okay.
Because of my slovenliness, I guess. But
okay.
I am having my monthly meeting in Santa Cruz this Saturday.
Okay.
And while this month's date is not at the website, last month's date is. It's the
okay.
same location, same contact information. So
okay.
if you go to the website under announcements and look at the Saturday, the Saturday meeting in Santa Cruz, there's a phone number there for Mike and Brenda. That's where you call, and that's where it's going to be at 7 o'clock this Saturday. I'd love to meet you.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to meet you, too. Okay, anyway, my comment, and I'll take it off the air because I know you're about ready to end. Maybe you can throw it in before it ends. So you have a blessed rest of the week, and we'll hear from you.
All right, Robert.
God bless you, brother.
All right, thank you, brother. Good talking to you. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast, and if you do live in the Santa Cruz area and would like to come out to a monthly meeting we have, it's just an open Bible discussion, questions and answers kind of situation in a home. There is information at the website. If you go there, it'll have last month's date, not this month's, although I may get this month's up before Saturday, who knows. But the information is the same except the date. So 7 o'clock this Saturday. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to help us pay the radio bills, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. Our website is www.thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Hope you'll tune in again tomorrow. We'll continue our discussion. God bless you.